This podcast was recorded on the date indicated with the link. The views and opinions expressed herein are as of the date recorded and should not be construed as an offer to buy or sell any securities. Such views and opinions may differ from those of DoubleLine Capital or its affiliates and are subject to change without notice. DoubleLine has no obligation to provide updates or changes. Welcome to Monday Morning Minutes, hosted by DoubleLine's fixed income asset allocation strategists and portfolio managers, Samuel Lau and Jeffrey Mayberry. Please direct any comments and suggestions to minutes@doubleline.com or see us on Twitter at @DLineMinutes.
Good morning and welcome to this week's episode of DoubleLine Monday Morning Minutes. I'm Jeff Mayberry along with Sam Lau.
Hey, hey.
Sam, we're recording just after the close on Thursday, April 1st, April Fool's Day. I think this is, looking back, this was my father's favorite holiday of the year.
That explains a lot.
Yeah. It's a day earlier than normal given the kind of weird scheduling for tomorrow with the New York Stock Exchange closed, but bond markets open. But no bond settlements. It's just very confusing. Listen, we're treating it as a holiday, so hopefully everyone has enjoyed their 3-day weekend. We just wrapped up the first quarter of 2021, and there's lots to talk about, even though the week was only a 4-day week. So let's hop right into the markets.
Yeah, that sounds good, Jeff. So as you mentioned, Wednesday was quarter end. So let's just talk about quarter to date numbers here as we look back, and it was a very strong period for risk assets. As I'm scanning across the page here, the S&P 500 put up 6.2% for the quarter, and the Bloomberg Commodity Index is up nearly 7%. The value and the cyclical sectors look like they stole the show within the S&P 500, with energy up over 30%, followed by the financial sector that was up just, let's just call it 16% there. The laggards here were consumer staples and technology, but both were up around 2% for the quarter. So a strong showing from all of the sectors underlying the S&P 500, with 11 in the green for the quarter here. So scanning the page here again, so it looks like small caps outperformed large caps by nearly 7 percentage points, with the Russell 2000 up almost 13% and the Russell 1000 up 6%. Value outperformed growth by more than 10%. The value index, the Russell 1000 value index, returned just over 11% for the quarter, and the growth index was up a percent.
So given that, when we came into the year, we were thinking, and I believe Mr. Gundlach talked about it on a webcast, was some sort of regime changes. And it seems like, given even though it's been a short time period, that has come through.
Yeah, a reversal of very long-term trends, I think, is what he was saying, is what he said in those things. And I definitely agree. It looks like it's certainly the case here.
It's too early to take a victory lap, but so far, so good.
Yeah, definitely. One quarter is a good period, though. So let's hope that we'll see if it lasts. So moving over to the other side of the coin, I guess, fixed income, it was the opposite in performance, with the ag down 3.4% on the quarter, making this the worst quarterly performance going back to 1976. And that's something that we've been noting in our weekly macro meetings internally, how we were just off to the worst start for the year. And then we finally came through the quarter, and it looks like we can mark that print in the books.
So this was in my lifetime, we can say in my lifetime, this is the worst quarter.
Unfortunately, can't say that of mine. So so within the egg, the worst performer was the U.S. investment grade corporate credit market. That was down 4.7%, followed by the U.S. Treasury market that using the index that is comprised within the Barclays aggregate, that was down 4.25%. So both of these are the worst quarters going back to 19. I believe it's the first quarter of 1980. If Greg Whiteley and if I recall what Greg Whiteley and Monica Erickson said today in our biweekly investment teams meeting. So saving the quarter for the Barclays aggregate was agency mortgage-backed securities only down about 1% for the quarter. So that rounds you back up to that 3.4% down for the ag for the quarter there. So a very weak start to 2021 in the most interest rate sensitive portions of the market, which isn't surprising. And we've been talking about the march higher in yields across, you know, pretty much from the belly of the curve on out to the long bond. You know, looking at the screen here, the 10-year treasury yield was up 83 basis points through a quarter end, and the long bond, the 30-year treasury yield was up 77 basis points over that same period. So it really highlights the importance of some of the things that, you know, you and I have been talking about, and every, you know, most people at the firm have been talking about, how the starting yield and duration, you know, really matter, and the importance of it as we started the year with a low yield on the, a relatively low yield on the 10-year of 90 basis points and 1.65% on the 10-year as of the end of D31 2020.
Yeah, so that, I mean, even though those moves are significant given where we started, you know, an 80 basis point move on the 10-year or the long bond isn't that, you know, great in terms of, you know, overall time period of how long these markets have been around. It just, as you said, just shows how much, you know, how long duration is and how low yields were. So, you know, if you had 90 basis point 10-year at the beginning of the year, you know, you can't really absorb that much of a rate move before you're going negative total return. If you have that 90 basis points over a quarter, you only get a quarter of that, you know, of that income over that time period. And that shows how, you know, because of those two numbers put together, the both the duration and the low income, and they kind of go together. Also, is that that's how you get to such bad total return numbers for a quarter.
Yeah, that's right. And, you know, given where we are today, it's a significantly much bigger cushion that we're seeing versus the lows of what we saw in 2020, when, you know, when basically we had a 50 basis point yield on the 10-year. At some point on the close, even, you know, it was lower than that on some of the intraday volatility that we saw throughout the 2020 mark period. But, you know, I'd much rather be at a, you know, 174 10-year than a 50 basis point 10-year.
Yeah, definitely. So, how would you feel about a 168 10-year? Because that's where we are today.
Given the
little rally that we had today.
Yeah, I'd still like it. I'll still take it again in contrast to that 50 basis point income that you supposedly pick up.
Yes. For sure.
So, you know, rounding out the page with fixed income, it looks like bank loans and high yield U.S. high yield corporates had positive prints for the quarter, up 1.8% and 85 basis points, respectively. Moving over to commodity land, the petroleum products, as I mentioned, you know, were up, leading the BCOM up for the quarter. But the petroleum products themselves were, for the most part, looking at these name at the individual commodities here, they're up double digits. The worst performer was heating oil. It was up only 20% for the quarter relative to something like unleaded gasoline, which was up almost double that number at just shy of 40% for the quarter. So a significantly different market that we saw relative to even the equity markets that we just talked about. The worst performers within the commodity complex were by and large the agriculture commodities, with the exception of soybeans and cotton. It looks like the rest, softs and grains, all closed in the red. So I think, you know, another area that we've been talking about throughout the quarter was the strength of the dollar, given the move that we saw since the end of last year. So I think that dollar strength did serve as a headwind to the commodity complex when it started to rally along, kind of side the pickup in yield. And that slowed the pace of commodity performance going into the end of the quarter. I see now that the Dixie closed yesterday, Wednesday, the end of the quarter, at just over 93 on the DXY, after having entered the year at below 90.
One sector you forgot to mention, though, is the precious metals. Why don't you highlight those returns? Because I see those as worse than the ags.
Yeah. Yeah. So when we take a look at, as a whole, the precious metal sectors and the ones that we look at within the GSCI complex, the gold futures and the silver futures, those were both strongly negative. Gold putting in a negative 9.6 on the front month contract basis, and silver down over 7%. A lot of that price action could have come as well, just given some of the, you know, one of the components within the yield march that we saw is we started to see real yields pick up as a, you know, using the TIPS market as a proxy there.
Right, and that makes sense. Why hold something that has no yield when you can get, you know, you can get your 174 on your 10-year?
So, yeah, I mean, it's a quite a strong start, I think, depending on where you want to look within financial markets for the first quarter. Fixed income looks to be a little bit more attractive there, you know, despite the being in the red for the quarter to date. I mean, just from an all-out yield perspective, you're much improved. I think from a credit or a potential default perspective, you also look like you're in a much better shape given the strength of the underlying economy that backs a lot of these names, particularly here in the U.S. So I think, you know, overall the outlook going forward, you know, especially, you know, for fixed income also is, you know, it's not as negative as people think.
Yeah, definitely agree. And that's, you can kind of see that, as you said, the bank loans have the best return, and then your junk bonds having the second best return, still positive or, you know, even positive, just shows how much those spreads have tightened on the back of further economic recovery here in the U.S.
Yeah. Yeah. So one of the things that I actually missed to check right before the call was, you know, one thing that we noted last week was the OPEC meeting that took place this week. I think the last day was today. And it does look like that they agreed. I'm just reading a quote here without the actual numbers, but it did look like the OPEC plus countries today agreed to cautiously start increasing production quotas. And not seeing when that's looking to take place, but early notes I had seen in terms of speculation was that it might begin as soon as May. But
yeah, what I saw was that they were going to increase production by 350,000 barrels per day in May and June, and then up to 450 in July. Now, the odd part is that oil rallied on this news. Mm-hmm. So it's up to 61 and change dollars per barrel on more production. So does that, the commentary that I've seen is kind of like, well, that doesn't make sense from a pure supply demand perspective. But the optimistic side is that the OPEC plus is forecasting increased demand coming up in the summer, and that's why they want to ease the production cuts or produce more because they think that the demand will pick up.
Yeah. So, you know, with the progress that we're making, you know, through various countries, you know, it does seem like it's a possibility that the demand will pick up. And I had also saw a report a few days ago just from those on the advisory committee for OPEC were saying that from a supply perspective as well, they expect that the surplus that we've been running should, you know, at least for the OPEC plus countries, should get back to the five-year average come July of this year. So that's a longer dated forecast, but those perhaps combined together with the outlook for potentially increased demand could be some of the reason why we saw the price action as we did today with the rally in the oil market.
Yeah.
So that wraps it up for the markets. Do you want to kick us off on what happened this week, from the macro front?
Yeah. On Tuesday, we don't normally talk about this because it's a survey data, and typically we, you know, have a leery eye towards surveys. But on Tuesday, the Conference Board Consumer Confidence Survey came out for March, and the reason we're highlighting it is that it was significantly higher than expectations at 109.7. Consensus estimate was 96.9, and it was 90.4 last month, so a significant jump up there. The consumer's assessment of the labor market also has improved at the highest level since March of last year. So again, when we're talking about optimism, maybe more demand out for oil over the summer, the consumers are confident of that kind of happening, and they're looking very much more optimistically at the upcoming months. Also on Tuesday, we're going to talk a little bit more about optimism for those of us that are homeowners. The Case-Shiller 20 city index was up 11% year over year. We thought the 10% that was this is through January. We thought the 10% in July, 10% that was in December was a high number. The January number popped up to 11%. So a significant move up there in home prices. It'll be interesting to see whether that certainly that pace can't continue forever, but whether that pace does slow down as rates have moved, as we've talked about, significantly higher over the past couple months. And then,
yeah, it's certainly good news for those people who are looking to sell their homes, right? But if you're just sitting in your home, I guess it could eventually, hopefully, if it maintains, it could eventually be good news when you look to sell. But if you're a buyer in this market, it's just got to be horrendous just seeing those price increases on that year over year basis.
And I don't think we've seen the kind of home equity cash out refi wave that we did see in 05, 06, 07. So with those home price appreciations, we're not really worried about defaults. And the leverage hasn't gotten too high yet. So yeah. I think, for most people that their home is their largest asset. And so I think that generally for the U.S. overall, that it's a good thing to have home prices appreciate. Maybe not at this pace, but certainly in the upward direction.
Agreed.
And then earlier today, the ISM, as you call it, manufacturing PMI for March came out. It was better than expectations at 64.7. Consensus was 61.5. This is the highest level since 1983. And of the 18 industries that reported, 17 reported growth in March. So very, very bullish number there for manufacturing in March. I guess when we were talking about these numbers in the past, it was for February, and everyone was like, "Oh, the weather." Maybe that actually was the case, as opposed to just an excuse this time. Kind of a little bit of a worrying note, maybe, is that the prices paid, ISM prices paid, remained at an elevated level of 85.6, which is a signal that manufacturers will eventually have to push through higher costs to consumers. Whether that comes through in the official inflation numbers will remain to be seen. But we do expect that there will be. There could be some jumps there in prices. And then also this week, President Biden unveiled an infrastructure plan. This was on Wednesday. He unveiled his infrastructure plan, dubbed the American Jobs Plan. It's interesting that kind of the two big things he started off with have America first in the names. No good acronyms like the CARES Act. But the American Jobs Plan, estimated at least right now to be $2.25 trillion over 8 years. So when we were talking about this earlier, Sam, that's $2.25 trillion over 8 years is a drop in the bucket. It doesn't really move the needle that much, but it does seem to be in sectors that do seem to have some need there. So $620 billion or so in transportation, same amount or $650 billion in broadband, electrical grid, clean water, property modernization. And then, there's $600 billion in R&D, manufacturing, and training. So really something that you list all these kind of subsectors or sectors where the money would go, and things that people have been saying for years that the American infrastructure needs to be upgraded and updated and modernized. And so it seems like if we could get some good movement here on the infrastructure plan, even at $2.25 trillion, seems to make sense to me. For the long term, it's not, maybe we won't see benefits from it right away, but certainly over the long term, these are needed changes.
Yeah, I can't agree more. I mean, it's just having the ability or being able to modernize our infrastructure is huge. I mean, I know you may feel the same way given the amount that you've traveled internationally. Especially for work. It's somewhat embarrassing coming back to some of our international airports here in the U.S. And just, when you go through the customs and you go off through the airports, especially on relative to some of the other more modern airports that we've seen, in our travels. And then you get onto the freeways or the highways or local roads, and it's just a pothole, every couple of, every couple of 100 feet or so, it feels like, and you just have to run an obstacle course when you're driving home. So it'll be nice to see some of the improvements here. And then also, you know, the move towards being a little bit, having a focus on cleaner energy too. It seems like it's long overdue as well.
But yeah, certainly if everyone's going to be driving electric cars, we certainly need to get that electrical grid updated.
Yeah, all of this sounds like a very strong positive for the commodity market as well. And when we think about some of the things that we've talked about, you know, the resources that are going to be required to make this happen as well, not to mention the jobs that this could potentially create. So hopefully, you know, it'll involve a lot of the private sector and less of the government sector once the actual contracts are put through. Otherwise, these things could be a bridge to nowhere, you know, like we've seen in the past with some of the other government projects.
Yeah, definitely. But I think that, you know, hopefully, at least when we're looking at it from here, it seems like it's a good start.
Yep.
And finally, again, this morning, we've got the unemployment number, the jobless numbers, total unemployment benefits for the week ending March 13th decreased by 1.5 million to 18.2. So as we did talk about last week, we're in that 18 to 20 gap. So next week we'll be, we'll see if we kind of break out of that range. You know, last week it was 19.7 to 18.2. So we're still bouncing around there. So hopefully we can start to see some better jobless numbers there, or unemployment benefit numbers there. And then tomorrow, so Friday, before people listen to this, but after we're recording, is the first Friday of the month. And so that's the jobs number. And the U3 unemployment rate is expected to improve from 6.2% in February to 6.0% in March. The non-farm payrolls are expected to increase by 650,000, up from 379 in February. And one thing to note there is that expectation of 650,000 is up significantly from last week, when last week we were talking about things to keep an eye on for this week. The consensus estimate was 565,000. So over that week, the estimate was up 85,000 jobs. And so you can expect that if that number improves even further from there, to the market will have a pretty good reaction to that. But, you know, given even last week, it was only 565,000. Maybe, you know, if there is some disappointment there, even if it's just a small amount of disappointment, maybe the market isn't going to be all doom and gloom on us.
Yeah. I mean, I do think that things could be looking up from the job front as we begin to roll in the summer, as long as we're able to maintain the you know, the lower levels of daily new case rates and, you know, hospitalizations, and as well as the progress of the vaccinations. It certainly feels like, you know, at least I am getting a little bit more optimistic for that. But, you know, we didn't get the question of the week, you know, from a listener this week. So we just thought that, you know, given that it's Friday is the jobs number, tomorrow we might as well try to dissect, you know, some of the, you know, or give people a way to think about the jobs data, and then allow them to maybe do some of dissect the data themselves.
Yeah, I was thinking that people must be really enjoying our self-selected questions. They haven't sent in any other questions.
Yeah, I guess that's a good way to look at it. But yeah, I'll go ahead and kick us off on this. The first Friday of each month, and given that we're in April now, the first Friday falls tomorrow, April 2nd. So that first Friday of each month typically means jobs day, I should say, as that's when the Bureau of Labor Statistics, the BLS, releases its monthly jobs report. I think the formal title for that is the Employment Situation Report. So out of that, there's typically two primary numbers that people look at, what's reported from the media. And it's in the headlines, we see the unemployment rate, the U3 unemployment rate for more specificity, and we'll get into that later, but also the non-farm payroll number. So it's the unemployment rate and non-farm payroll numbers that are the two primary numbers that come out of this jobs report. So, you know, starting out with the unemployment rate, the U3 rate, that comes from the current population study. Just like it's just like the government. There's a lot of complexities to it, and it's probably very inefficient. But it's also, this current population survey is also known as the household survey. So If you have any interest, you can look up on either of those key terms there. But starting again with the U3 from the household survey, I refer to it as headline rate because that's what's frequently referenced in the media. And as we've talked about numerous times here on the show, Jeff, we think that the U3 currently undercounts the negative impact that the pandemic has probably had on the labor market. And that's just based on the way that things are categorized and defined. Now, the components to calculate U3 are essentially the number of employed people and the number of unemployed people. And together, this unemployed and employed components, they make up the labor force. So in looking through the BLS website, which is actually kind of horrendous to navigate through, but you can find your way through with enough digging there. One other thing I recommend if you do go through digging is type into the Google BLS and glossary, and that'll get you to the glossary page of the BLS. I actually tried to find it navigating through the site. I wasn't able to do so very quickly, so I just resorted to the Google for that. But it's a good resource if you want to go through and just find some of these definitions yourself, because they do become important in trying to analyze what the changes in the numbers actually mean. So with that, the BLS criteria to be considered employed is that at a summary level, you have to have been paid for work for at least a minimum of 1 hour of work during the period that they use to calculate this jobs report, the household survey. So the criteria to be considered unemployed, however, is that you are not employed during that reference period, but that you made efforts to find work at some point during the last 4 weeks. So what's important to note here is that if someone is out of work, but they haven't actively sought to find work during that 4 week period, then they're not considered unemployed. And in fact, they're actually dropped out of the labor force just by definition. So this is important, I think, especially today, as many individuals have lost their jobs because of the pandemic-related shutdowns through no fault of their own. Because if you think back there, here in California, especially, there was a number of industries that were deemed not essential. And those industries weren't allowed to remain open in many states. So if you're unemployed in that industry, then you're probably not going to be actively searching for work during that 4 week period. And if that's the case, then you're getting dropped out of the labor force. So bringing this all back to the headline unemployment number, that is the U3 number, that's calculated by taking the number of people who are counted as unemployed and then dividing it by the labor force. And in doing so, that therein lies the potential, I think, for the distortion of the U3 as an indicator of the health of the labor market, because it doesn't account for those people who are out of work but have been dropped out of the labor force by the BLS criteria. So, I mean, when we look forward to what we think might transpire tomorrow on Friday, if the U3 rate declines, it could be perceived that the overall labor market has improved. But if it's because people have dropped out of the labor force, then that's not necessarily a good thing because they're still out of work. They're just not being picked up by the BLS criteria. So in looking back for a recent reference point, that's what we saw and what we actually talked about back in January for the January jobs data. So looking back at that time period, the U3 rate improved to 6.3% from the previous month of 6.7%. And that was largely due to the fact that you had over 400,000 people categorized out of the labor force because they weren't actively searching for work. So that's why it's important, I think, to, as we always talk about, to dig through the data. And to, that's also another reason why we also look at the U6 rate, which is another unemployment rate. And it's actually known as the underemployment rate. So tying this to the U3, the U6, what it does is it adds back those people that I just talked about, those who were declassified out of the labor force. So these are the individuals that may want to work, but they haven't looked for work in the last 4 weeks leading up to report. And again, this could be because the industry that they are typically employed by has been effectively locked down. So this cohort, if you want to look it up, is referred to as those individuals that are marginally attached to the labor force. So the U6 adds back these people. But in addition to that, they also add in the number of people who are working part-time involuntarily. So those are the individuals that may want full-time work or may have been, let go of their previous full-time job, but out of circumstance, all they can find is part-time work. So these are the marginally employed and those marginally attached to the labor force. So with this in mind, this is the reason why we think U6 might be a better measurement of what the true unemployment landscape looks like today. And, incidentally, it also corroborates the numbers that we talk about each week from the total unemployment insurance benefit claims that we highlight on Thursday. So you just mentioned that it was a 18.2 million number this week of the total individuals that are receiving the unemployment insurance claims and benefits. If you take that 18.2 and divide it by the labor force, you get to right around 11 to 12%, which is right around the U6 rate. And then I guess one other thing to note, since we've mentioned in the past, is that 11% that's kind of jerry-rigged using the unemployment insurance claims, which matches the U6 rate, also matches what Jerome Powell has often referenced as what he thinks is a more accurate reflection of the unemployment rate. So it kind of all wraps back together with this idea of people not falling out of work, but not being picked up by the various classifications that the BLS uses. So, I guess the moral of the story is, you have to look through the numbers, you have to really, piece through to see what the moving parts are underneath. But, you gave us the expectations for the jobs report, in terms of the U3 and then also the payroll numbers. But, let's say if we do get to that expectation, the U3, and we get a 6% U3, coming down from the 6.2% that we currently are at, that seems like an improvement at face value. But, with some of these tools that we provided today, you can watch and see if people actually fell out or came back into the labor force. So there isn't a U6 economist estimate that's provided for Bloomberg. But if U6 rises or even stays the same while the U3 rate improves, then that could be a signal that's time to get under the hood and look at the details that surround the labor force.
Right. And there was one number to look at, we would say the U6 number.
Yeah, I think that's right. At least during periods of economic weakness that are really defined, like this pandemic is, or this pandemic recession is, by a significant and material loss of jobs. Because one of the things, when you take a look at the differential between the U6 rate and the U3 rate, it tends to blow out, if you will, during periods of economic recessions. And I think that's when the data starts being less accurate in its ability to capture who truly is unemployed, how it's classified as whether or not they're in the labor force or not. One of the other things that I dug through as well is that there's about 10 million people who are counted as unemployed through the BLS measure versus the 18.2 through the various unemployment claims benefits. Part of perhaps the reason for that is something that I alluded to, the fact that with the BLS, you have to claim that you've been looking for work in the last 4 weeks in order to be counted in the labor force and as unemployed. But with some of these state as well as the federal programs through the emergency PUA, the Pandemic Unemployment Assistance Plan, and the PEUC, which I believe stands for Pandemic Employment Unemployment Claims, maybe something like that, but no, Pandemic Emergency Unemployment Claims. Both of those are federal programs, but amongst those and the state programs, the 18.2, the difference between that 18.2 and the 10 million that the BLS claims is partially attributed to a relaxing of the uninsurance claim benefits, because you traditionally, before the pandemic, you needed to be able to say that you were actively looking for work in the last week in order to receive uninsurance benefits. I believe it was during the CARES Act, they basically relaxed those rules and said, listen, if you're in one of those unessential job functions and you are not able to work because of the emergency related shutdowns, it makes sense that you're not going to be looking for work in the last week. So they've relaxed those rules, allowing for more people to now receive the unemployment. Thus, I think there's that kind of that 8 million differential between the unemployment insurance benefits and the number of people who are counted as unemployed via the BLS.
Yeah, and I think that that makes sense given kind of the environment that we're in, and that, you know, it'll be interesting to see next time there's a recession, that whether or how the government response is, and whether that U3 number again doesn't make sense. Maybe normal times, as we're coming out of recession, as people are finding jobs, then we can focus back on that U3 number, the headline unemployment number, as something that's kind of indicative of how the economy is doing. But in recession times, certainly the U6 number is more important. And as you said, with Powell talking about unemployment being up at that level, and the Fed focused on quote unquote full employment, or that number is one that we need to keep an eye on, so that we know, or we can kind of deduce how likely or unlikely the Fed is to hike rates or kind of slow down the economy.
Yeah, and with Powell looking perhaps at that U6 number, it gives him more leeway to achieve his average inflation targeting goals as well. So
what you're saying is the Fed looks at this underemployment number, which is bigger than the headline number. They like to look at, as we talked about last week, core PCE, which is the lower inflation than lower inflation metric, or historically has been a lower inflation metric than the headline CPI that everyone looks at. And so the Fed is kind of cherry picking which data points they want to look at so they can keep rates lower for longer.
I would never make an accusation like that, but let's just say they moved the goalpost to suit their needs at the time. So let's call their targets transitory.
Okay. Yeah.
So
that's good. I like that.
Yeah. So, you know, in wrapping it up, the last major data point that comes out of the BLS reports is the non-farm payrolls. And to get technical here, it comes from a different report than the unemployment ones, which, if I'll remind you again, since it was so long ago that I talked about, it's the current population survey, aka the household survey for the unemployment data. So for the non-farm payrolls, it's called the current employment statistics report, also known as the payrolls report. So the data here is different than the household survey used for unemployment and the labor force numbers. Instead of surveying households on their employment status, the individuals living in the households on their employment status, the payroll report surveys roughly 150,000 businesses and government agencies. And the key difference between the payroll report and the unemployment report is that the payrolls attempt to count the number of jobs, while the unemployment report counts the number of people working. So in payroll, from what I understand from this, if a person had three jobs during the reference period, then that would count as three jobs in the payroll numbers. But in the unemployment report, if a single person has multiple jobs, then it's only counted as one person employed. So you can't really compare the numbers of the payrolls to the number of employed and try to figure out, you know, how many multiple job holders there really are out there, because I think one of the many of the job functions that are counted in the household data aren't counted in the payroll data. So I think, as the name implies, with the non-farm payroll report, farmers aren't included in the payroll data. Nonprofits aren't counted in the payroll data. Neither are sole proprietorships and certain government payrolls. I think the CIA was one of those not counted in the government payroll. So they're a little bit secretive about that. Go figure. But other than that, the headline data from the payroll data is much more straightforward than the employment report. And we typically just look at the change over the previous period. Sometimes we'll look at it by industry function, but I think both reports do offer a lot of minutia, and, you know, some of the data can be quite interesting if you're into that kind of thing, as they break it out by, in a number of ways, you know, at minimum by sector, demographics, and function. So you can really, you know, dig into the weeds there.
Yeah, and it helps from people who you don't have, you know, numerator, denominator. You're not trying to worry about what changed to get you to that unemployment number. It's just like here's the jobs number. It's obviously in thousands, usually in thousands, even though we may, maybe we'll get a million print tomorrow. but it certainly helps people wrap their mind around, you know, how many jobs are out there versus changing numerator denominator. It's just a pure number.
Yeah, you heard it here first, everyone. Jeff Maber is calling for a million net change in payrolls, non-farm payrolls tomorrow.
Well, if it happens, then you know maybe it's one of those things where you just predict an outlandish number. When it happens, you just pat yourself on the back, and if it doesn't, you say, "Well, I was just too optimistic."
That's right. That's right.
And we are recording early, so but people will listen to this afterwards, so we're not front running ourselves.
That's right. Timestamp it.
That's right. Well, that was a good interesting breakdown, Sam. I thought, you know, ahead of all the numbers coming out tomorrow, I thought that was good breakdown for everybody.
Yeah. So what do we got going on next week?
Next week's a little light week. You know, we do get ISM, ISM Services PMI comes out on Monday. That's estimated to be up big again, 58.5 versus 55.3 last month. Again, people were blaming the weather for the lower number last month. So expecting a big increase here on Monday from that. On Wednesday, we get the Fed meeting minutes. Given the Fed the Fed meeting from March 17th was a little bit of a nothing really going on. I don't really expect much from the minutes either. And then on Friday, we get the PPI, the Producer Price Index number. It's expected to come in at 3.8, up 1% from the 2.8% number from February. As we did talk about, 3 weeks ago, maybe, this is where the base effects start to come in. So expect these numbers to be very high, but then kind of wait and see for the next few months to see how persistent they are and whether they are transitory, as the Fed seems to think they will be, or whether they persist longer than the market expects. And then next week is also the IMF World Bank spring meetings. A couple of things to highlight is both Powell and Yellen are scheduled to speak. So we'll be interesting to see. I don't know. We don't know what topics they are scheduled to speak about, but we'll always be interested to see what they say and whether it does move any markets, and whether they kind of can talk about their expectations or setting expectations for the future in the markets.
Yeah, that's a good wrap up for what to expect next week. And I've been remiss. I should have thanked you for joining me on this podcast today on your day off here. You've had a vacation this week, so hopefully it was enjoyable. And thanks for coming out and joining.
Yeah, hopefully you didn't have to work too hard while I was gone, and we'll be back together, getting after it again next week.
That sounds good. Yeah, it's actually been a quiet 2 weeks. It feels like in the markets, just given the spring break and then the shortened holiday week this week. So glad to have you back next week when everything will probably pick up a little bit. But I wanted to thank all of our listeners out there today for joining us. Monday Morning Minutes. You can always pick up the latest episode every Monday before the bell. So we're available now on SoundCloud, Stitcher, iTunes, Spotify, and the Google Podcasts. Don't forget, please hit us up on the Twitter at DLine Minutes or on the email at minutes@doubleline.com with any questions or comments there. We'd love to hear from you.
And we'll assume that if you're not sending us questions, that our self-selected questions are informative and useful. So we'll keep going with that optimistic side of things. Don't forget, you can find out more information about DoubleLine at our website, doubleline.com. And our YouTube channel is youtube.com/DoubleLineCapital, where Jeff Sherman, our DoubleLine's deputy CIO, sat down with portfolio manager Ken Shinoda on the latest episode of DoubleLine's Channel 11 News, where they talk about the last 12 months in markets since the COVID crisis and the pandemic and the shutdowns and all the craziness that has happened over those past 12 months. You can follow Mr. Sherman and Sam on their podcast, The Sherman Show. You can follow them on Twitter at Sherman Show Pod. I'll talk to everyone again next week.
DoubleLine's intellectual property. No portion of this presentation may be published, reproduced, transmitted, or rebroadcast in any media in any form without express written permission of DoubleLine.
DoubleLine has no obligation to provide any updates or changes. To receive permission from DoubleLine, please contact media@doubleline.com. Neither DoubleLine nor any of its affiliates makes any representation or warranty as to the accuracy or completeness of the statements or any information contained in this podcast and any liability therefor, including in respect of direct, indirect, or consequential loss or damage, is expressly disclaimed. DoubleLine is not providing any financial, economic, legal, accounting, or tax advice in this podcast. The receipt of this podcast by any listener is not to be taken as constituting the giving of investment advice by any DoubleLine entity or individual to that listener, nor to constitute such person a client of any DoubleLine entity. The portfolio risk management process includes an effort to monitor and manage risk, but does not imply low risk.
Copyright 2021 DoubleLine Capital.